Coming up on KUCB News, the Coast Guard has completed its 2-year investigation into the sinking of the FV Destination, and President Donald Trump passed through Alaska last week on a refueling stop. Stay tuned.
Programming on KUCB is made possible by Redfish Electronics, now providing new, used, and refurbished computers, tablets, iPods, MP3s, phones, phone accessories, and flat screens. We also carry external hard drives for your digital storage needs. Redfish Electronics is located in the airport parking lot next to Northport Rentals. Redfish Electronics can be reached at 359-2205.
Good afternoon. You're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM on Alaska. I'm Laura Craigle with some local news on Monday, March 4th, 2019. The U.S. Coast Guard is considering civil penalties against the owners of the FV Destination, the crab boat that capsized 2 years ago in the Bering Sea, killing all 6 crew members. The potential for penalties is just one takeaway from a new report released yesterday in which investigators identified a number of mistakes that contributed to the deadly accident. Captain Lee Boone is the Coast Guard's chief of investigations. He unveiled the report at a press conference in Seattle, describing 4 primary factors that left the destination in a, quote, vulnerable condition.
A failure of the owner to ensure accurate stability instructions were available, improper loading, the decision by the captain to get underway in heavy freezing spray conditions, and crew fatigue.
To his first point, Boone says the Coast Guard is considering civil penalties against the vessel's owners in Washington State because they failed to provide the captain with federally mandated information about how much gear the destination could carry safely. The boat's stability book had not been updated in more than 2 decades.
Since 1993, some changes have been made to the vessel. Those should have been incorporated into updated stability instructions that then the master could follow.
Without that information, Boone says Captain Jeff Hathaway overloaded the boat with crab pots. That was the second problem. The third was Hathaway's decision to head out after the National Weather Service gave notice of bad icing conditions.
The vessel got underway despite those warnings and subjected itself to icing on the vessel. And so icing on the deck and on the crab pots themselves likely contributed to a stability problem with the vessel that in turn caused it to capsize and sink.
Why didn't the crew beat that ice off the vessel to help keep it stable? Boone says the answer, in issue number 4, was exhaustion.
We had learned that the crew was very fatigued when they left Dutch Harbor the night before the incident. And so the report concludes that the crew members were likely sleeping and perhaps were not on the deck removing the ice that would have prevented that poor stability condition from occurring.
Boone says those factors combined left the crew with a, quote, limited ability to survive the harsh elements of the Bering Sea. In the aftermath of their deaths, he says the Coast Guard is following investigators' recommendation to increase efforts that encourage stability training for fishermen and boat owners. But Boone says the agency has declined to pursue new safety regulations that would specify crab pot weight, require owners to maintain records of vessel changes, or create policies to address crew exhaustion.
Commandant's position that the existing set of regulations was sufficient to have prevented this casualty. The missing piece here was compliance with those existing regulations.
Data show the crab fleet has made huge safety strides since the 1990s, when 75 fishermen died while crabbing in the Bering Sea. The loss of the destination crew marked the fishery's deadliest accident in more than a decade. In maritime news this winter fishing season, the Coast Guard medevaced 3 mariners over the course of 4 days last week from vessels near Cold Bay. Last Monday, officials say the FV Verdal was 70 miles north of the community when a crew member reported suffering from chest pains. The Coast Guard cutter Midget launched a Dolphin helicopter crew to medevac the man from the vessel and take him to Cold Bay for treatment. Then last Tuesday, the same helicopter crew rescued an FV Ocean Peace crew member who was displaying symptoms symptoms of appendicitis. That vessel was 115 miles north of Cold Bay at the time, and the man was taken there first before he was transported to Anchorage for further care. Finally, on Thursday, another helicopter evacuated a crew member from the FV Golden Alaska. The boat was 36 miles northwest of Cold Bay when the woman began suffering from symptoms of a respiratory infection. She was transported to Unalaska for medical treatment. President Donald Trump was in Alaska last week. While on his way back to Washington from peace talks with North Korea's Kim Jong-un in Vietnam, Air Force One stopped Thursday at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage. It was Trump's first time addressing an Alaska audience as president.
Coming in and we're landing, and I say, you know, I have a choice. I can stay on the plane and relax as we fuel up, right? As we fuel up. Or I said, how good are they out there? Somebody looked at me and said, they're the best. You're supposed to be the best, right? You're right on the front. I said, all right, so let's go. Put on the tie, put on the shirt. But I wanted to be with you, and it's an honor to be with you.
Trump spoke for about 20 minutes to a gathering of soldiers in front of an F-22 Raptor fighter jet. His remarks covered a wide range of topics, some general, some specific to Alaska.
And actually, over here, my grandfather was up in Alaska for a long time. He was looking for gold. He was searching for gold. He didn't find it, but he started opening up little hotels for those looking for gold, and it worked out. But he was up in and maybe that's why I've always had a very special place in my heart for Alaska.
The president had high praise for members of the armed forces and spoke at length about his administration's military accomplishments, both domestically and abroad. Trump said that includes dozens of F-35s in Alaska, as well as new money for missile defense coming into the state in the next few years. He touted his administration's support for opening the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling, and he had kind words for Alaska's governor, Mike Dunleavy, with whom he had a one-on-one meeting.
He's not only one of the best governors in the United States, he's definitely the largest. Where is Mike? Look at that man. He's all man. Look at him. Congratulations, Mike. And thank you for being here. He heard I was going to stop, and he got on a plane, and he was able to get here, and that's a great honor.
Trump also spent a large share of his speech touting the strength of the national economy. The president did not address his nuclear talks with North Korea, which reportedly ended abruptly after no deal was reached. Governor Dunleavy's budget continues to face criticism. That includes an accusation from the state's budget expert saying the administration has not provided justification for many of its far-reaching proposals. But as KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports, the governor is standing behind his plan to cut more than $1.5 billion from the state budget.
While lawmakers have been hearing a lot of criticism of the budget, Dunleavy says in a visit to Matanuska, Susitna Borough, and Anchorage, he heard good things.
Their message to me was, this is why you were elected. We want to see you continue to have a discussion with the people of Alaska on a balanced budget, one that revenues and expenditures meet without having to take the PFD or tax Alaskans.
Dunleavy says national news has reinforced his reasoning for the budget. He cited news reports that New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has expressed concern about upper-income residents leaving the state as a result of taxes. And congressional Republicans want to declare the national debt to be a national security threat.
Those things are indicative of, once again, spending that's out of control, individuals leaving states that are high-tax states. So for me, it makes it even more important that we get our fiscal house in order this year than let it linger, because we are running out of savings and it's going to be a problem for the state.
The budget received tough criticism during Tuesday's Senate Finance Committee hearing from David Teal. He's the director of the Nonpartisan Division of Legislative Finance, which advises the legislature on budget issues. And Teal wasn't criticizing the content of the budget, but he says the Dunleavy administration hasn't offered an adequate explanation for the proposed changes. He noted that committee members have raised similar concerns.
It seems apparent that many of you share my disappointment in the lack of evaluation and analysis to support the governor's proposals.
Teal is known for his normally measured tone when delivering budget analyses to lawmakers, but he didn't hold back about his reaction to the lack of supporting documents that were included with Dunleavy's budget.
Looking at the lack of justification, I began to wonder whether the budget was designed in some way to create chaos.
Thiel says it's unrealistic for the legislature to analyze and pass the budget by the scheduled end of the session on April 14th, given how little information it includes.
Maybe there's some hope on the governor's part that you'll just throw up your hands and say, we don't have time to evaluate this. We'll just go along with what the governor proposes because we don't have much of a way to come up with alternatives. We don't have the time. Or maybe creating chaos is just a clever way to force a conversation that needs to happen.
Dunleavy says there's enough justification for the cuts. He rejects the criticism and says Thiel's been a part of the process as the budget has grown out of control. The governor says a lot of thought went into preparing the budget.
Probably more this year than any time in the past. We've tipped over every stone. We've looked under every layer we possibly could to come up with places where we could save money, to come up with places that we believe may not impact the majority of Alaskans.
Dunleavy acknowledges that the cuts to public schools and ferries affect a large portion of Alaskans. And he repeats that the budget closes a $1.6 billion gap without using a broad-based tax or reducing permanent fund dividends. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Public testimony last week ran nearly 2-1 against legislation that would pay extra checks to Alaskans to make up for the amounts deducted from permanent fund dividends the last 3 years. More than 100 Alaskans spoke at the Thursday hearing, including Juneau resident David Noon. He says he's concerned about the potential effect of paybacks.
For a lot of Alaskans, the PFD is a substantial source of income, and reduced PFDs would hit them the hardest. But I also know that reductions in our schools and hospitals, senior care facilities, ferries, everything else is going to, in the long term, hit everyone, including Alaska's most vulnerable, harder.
Dunleavy has proposed two bills that would pay out nearly $3,700 over the next 3 years to Alaskans who have lost PFD money since 2016. The legislation would reduce the permanent fund's earnings by an estimated $100 million each year. It's the loss of that money that raised concern among most of the testifying Alaskans, but others said that PFDs should never have been cut. Charlie Pierce in Kenai says Dunleavy was elected in part due to his campaign pledge to pay back the reduced PFDs.
I want to just remind the elected officials that are there tonight that there was recently an election in Alaska, and I think this issue was really at the forefront of that election.
Former Governor Bill Walker vetoed half of the PFD money in 2016. The following 2 years, it was the legislature that passed PFD cuts. The 47th running of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race is underway. 52 dog teams sped out of Willow yesterday for the 1,000-mile race to Nome. KNOM's Ben Matheson has more on this year's competitive field.
With 35 men and 17 women slated to run, it's the smallest field of mushers starting an Iditarod in decades. But that doesn't mean that the competition is any easier. Two Rivers musher Allie Zirkel is among the contenders.
Oh, it's incredibly competitive, just as competitive as it was last year. I mean, the sad part is that we've lost some of the folks who, do it for the sake of doing the Iditarod. But maybe they'll come back again next year.
This year's race includes 5 past champions as well as 10 rookies. After poor snow forced the race to relocate twice in recent years, officials say conditions are better than average. One of last year's top rookies, Matt Hall, is happy with what he's hearing.
Seems like a lot of snow, so also a slow trail, which is kind of good. We train a little slower than most teams. We compete in the Yukon Quest 1,000-mile race right before going into Iditarod each year, so we're kind of geared down a little bit. So I'm looking forward to another kind of soft trail out there.
And the recent weeks of good weather have 4-time champion Martin Boozer feeling optimistic about the trail.
Forecast looks really good, including the trip up and over the Alaska Range. That's always the challenge. The burn has gotten to the point where it's really not the burn anymore. The burn has grown up and matured quite a bit, and there's a defined trail through it.
Trail crews built about 20 bridges over open water in the Dalzell Gorge area. The race's most technical sections are within the first couple days, a fact that rookie Jessica Klaika knows well.
I'm just going to take it one checkpoint at a time. And, you know, the sections that we all hear about, my husband keeps saying, they're not that long of sections. You're going to be fine. When I keep talking, well, what about the steps? He's like, they're not that long. You know, it's going to be a few minutes of sort of terror and then you'll be fine.
Mushers can anticipate spotty snow around the Iditarod checkpoint, and much of the sea ice along the coast is in poor shape after severe winter storms pounded the region. A winner is expected to reach Nome in about 9 days and will take home $50,000 as well as a new truck out of the race purse of $500,000. For KNOM, I'm Ben Matheson in Anchorage.
And that's the news from Unalaska. I'm Laura Craigle, and you're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM. Find us online at kucb.org. And please stay tuned for your local and marine weather forecasts.